Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you three free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Scott Colbert, Chief Economist at Commerce Trust Co. in Kansas City, is it? Missouri?
The bank is headquartered in Kansas City, Missouri. I'm domiciled in St. Louis. Not that that matters a heck of a lot.
Well, it matters if you're playing in the Super Bowl, but we'll talk about all that. Well, not the Super Bowl, but we'll talk about the Midwest, the economy. And spoiler alert a little bit here, Scott, your views now are surprisingly optimistic, if I dare say, on the economy. Tell me why.
Yeah, it's surprisingly optimistic and surprising to me that I'm as optimistic as I am, given the setup last year of an inverted yield curve, the Fed aggressively raising rates, the leading economic indicators falling at a level that have always predicted basically 10 out of 10 or 12 out of the 12 post-World War II recessions. And the big reason is largely that, you know, for whatever reason, the economy has been able to withstand these higher rates, has actually reaccelerated. And inflation, of course, has performed or rolled over, if you will, more aggressively or more assertively than the Fed thought or the markets thought. It does appear in retrospect that certainly some of the inflation was reasonably transitory. And we're working our way back to towards a very nominal inflationary level. And so the big difference this year compared to last year is the Fed actually has ammo to provide some help to the economy, even if they need to. And right at the moment, they don't need to provide any help at all because, of course, oddly enough, you know, economic growth has accelerated, not decelerated, but accelerated.
Okay. So here is maybe our first contrarian take of the day, which is that you don't think the Fed is going to cut in March or May or indeed anytime soon.
Well, I see that they certainly have room to begin to ease at some point, but it's really going to depend upon how, you know, the first quarter or two, you know, economic growth plays out. To the extent that it's still, you know, at trend, and I think the Fed believes that trend growth is something like a real growth of 1.8%, nominal growth of 4%, and basically 2% or 2.2% inflation, a deflator of something like that. We're still growing it, you know, on a year-over-year basis, on a nominal basis at 5.8%. So, you know, we're still above trend nominal growth. Real growth, of course, year over year, 2023. These growth rates are always a little quirky, all right? When you hear that the economy grew 2.5% last year, that's the number that you hear the most. That number means that for the full four quarters of 2023, economic activity was, say, we'll call it $29 trillion. That would have been 2.5% bigger than the year before. So it's a four quarter over four quarter number. But when you look at the fourth quarter over fourth quarter, you're looking at a 3.1% growth rate. So that's the acceleration I'm talking about, kind of hidden within the macro numbers, that we actually have, you know, kind of an improving economy right at the margin.
Even though the previous quarter was 5%, just about, right? 4.9 quarter. Yeah.
Exactly. The previous quarter was very hot. And then, of course, it was 3.3. But when you think about growth last year, it was basically 2% in the first half, 4% in the second half, which averages to that 3 when you look at the quarter over quarter number, 3.1 quarter over quarter, fourth quarter to fourth quarter, but 2.5% cumulatively when you look at the entire year versus the entire year of 2022.
Does the Fed even need to cut rates at this point with the way things are going?
I think, you know, the Fed has to work through a process just to get there. The first thing they have to do, and maybe they'll start to do that today, is to talk about a balance of risks rather than still the risks skewed to the upside from an inflationary perspective. So they've got to balance those. They've got to address, you know, what they're doing on the quantitative tightening side. I think they need to, you know, suggest that there's some tapering to that before they can even think about lowering rates. Then they've got to bring a new group together. Powell has to bring a newer group and new voting members together on a consensus basis. And there's still a couple hawks out there that have made their point that, you know, let's wait until we see the whites of the eyes of inflation roll over so we don't make the cardinal sin of a central banker's mistake to lower rates and then immediately have to reverse direction because we said, uh-oh, we were wrong about this. Mm-hmm. In other words, they've got, I mean, unless the economy is cooling rapidly and moving towards a recession, I don't think there's a lot of, a lot of reason the Fed's going to come up with to aggressively or assertively lower rates. They have their dual mandate, of course, which, of course, is full employment and inflation. And right now, if you still had to balance those two things, obviously, there's clearly full employment at the moment. There's cooling inflation. But I think, you know, it's hard to say that just because the core PCE has been at 2% for 6 months, that it's mission accomplished.
Yeah. And Fed fund futures are still pricing in, last I looked, a 50% chance of a rate cut, not at today's meeting, but in March.
Yeah. I mean, normally the Fed fund futures market, and the Fed doesn't like to fool the markets. They don't like to be, not know what's going on. I'm sure that post the January meeting, we'll have a firmer grasp on whether or not there's anything likely coming in March. So post the meeting, Powell's press conference tomorrow, I think the market will aggressively or assertively start to move towards that 0% probability of a rate hike come March.
Interesting. And can stocks continue to advance without rate cuts? How much of that is maybe priced in already? Is that a question?
Well, I'm not our, chief stock picker, if you will, for the bank, but we spend a lot of time together. I think we know that in aggregate, when you look at the aggregate S&P 500, if you will, that it's stretched in valuation, primarily coming from that valuation of those Magnificent Seven or rapidly moving towards the Super Six or whatever. But with Tesla down, that it's hard to say that they deserve to be part of the Magnificent Seven, at least so far year to date. If you look at the earnings of the S&P 500, they're likely to reach peak earnings this year in aggregate and beat the 2022 peak earnings by a bit. But it's entirely driven by those largest six stocks, because if you looked at earnings of the other 494 companies, they're actually still down relative to their peak earnings in 2022. So it's a bifurcated market, obviously. Does this end badly? It probably ends badly sooner or later, but the net trend early on, though, is for the lowest or cheapest stocks to get pulled along or up towards, towards the technicals of the big caps that are in such good position. I mean, we did just break into on January 19th, a new high for the S&P, and oddly enough, new highs are followed by, you know, usually new highs for quite a while. And then the Dow Jones has broken into new high technical territory as well. So the technicals are awfully firm for the market. And I think it will, while it hasn't broadened out yet year to date, I think you'll find that this is the first time we can figure out that the Russell 2000 is still down in bear market territory while the S&P 500 is at new record levels. So I, in general, that has almost always pulled smaller and mid-cap stocks up. We have an over to mid-cap stocks, less on the small sector, because a lot of those small-cap stocks don't have any profits anyhow, but in the Russell 2000. But if you look at the mid-cap 400, basically every company smaller than Whirlpool is pretty profitable, reasonably profitable, and we think likely to get pulled along, to a considerable extent this year. So bottom line is we're fully invested in stocks. We're not overweight, because we do know that in aggregate, when you look at the aggregate valuations and you look at Shiller's tape PE ratio, that cyclically adjusted price earnings, where he goes back 10 full years in earnings, today's market has a PE of about 30. Historically, we've been there about 18 times based on 10-year trailing earnings. At 30, the average return to the market over the next decade has been a low of about 2% and a high of about 8%, and an average return of about 5%. So unfortunately, that's the valuation level of the S&P 500 today looking forward, and we can get 5% by throwing a dart in the bond market for 10 years. So we really, if we had to, our biggest commitment would be towards investment grade fixed income, or just call it the JP Morgan strategy. Right now, JP Morgan just issued 10-year notes at about 158 basis points off the 10-year. 10-year treasuries, 4.10. So you can get a 560-ish return just by buying, JP Morgan. And JP Morgan is like the government. It will be here 10 years from now.
Yeah. Now, where this leaves bonds, though, if the Fed doesn't cut, won't that be a problem for bonds?
Yeah, I think, you're going to see a gradual re-steepening from the back end. Then an eventual cut in the front end that brings back a more normalized curve. It's just going to take a little bit of time. The big rally that we had in bonds finally last year, where, the aggregate market was up 6% or so, is not likely to be repeated this year, but you're likely to get your coupon. So, you're starting out the year with a 5%+ coupon, in the aggregate market. And, as the year progresses, I think you're going to get, a very coupon-like level of income, which is, something you haven't really had the chance to do in a long, long time, maybe 15 or 16 years. So your 10-year over-under now for the stock market is 5% or 5.5%, or even 6% if you want to stretch into, say, the average yield of the BBB credit market, right, which is about 6%. So you stretch to 10-year BBB corporates, don't push your way down into the non-investment grade, you're likely to get a 6% return over the next decade. That becomes a tougher bar for stocks, to compete with over a long period of time. So we do like bonds. Yeah, it's always difficult to tell about the short-term, returns on bonds. But in the long run, if you took all the investment grade bond funds, and I run one, CFBNX, $1 billion in it, it's four-star Morningstar fund right at the moment. With 95% certainty, I can tell you what the return of the investment grade corporate bond market is going to be over the next decade. It's going to be the 10-year treasury plus about 50 or 60 basis points. And that's historically where it's always been, with huge correlation. I can't tell you what the stocks are going to do over 10 years, but historically they've been in a range of 2-8% based upon valuations today.
What about the 10-year though? I mean, that's a pretty big question mark, isn't it? I mean, it's gone, considering where it was during COVID, at 20 whatever basis points, and now 4.1.
So the 10-year treasury in the long run is pulled along by two things. It's pulled upward by nominal growth, or towards nominal growth, and pulled downwards towards real growth plus some inflation premium. The inflation premium for the 10-year treasury over long periods of time has been about 1.2%. So if the Fed can really get inflation down to 2, and by the way, that PCE 2 translates to about 2.4% CPI. Because the PCE, the way it's measured, they think it's a better measure, but basically it averages 38 to 40 basis points less than the CPI. So if they can get core PCE to 2, that means you've got 2.4% inflation, add 1.2 or 1.25 to that. In the long run, the 10-year treasury ought to be about 3.75. Now, today, nominal growth is still 5.8%, which pulls the 10-year treasury upward. It's still pulling it up. Of course, for a while there, we had nominal growth that was 9. All right. So this is why it was nutty for the 10-year, anybody to think the 10-year had any rally in it at all for a while. But eventually, we're going to get back to probably something like 4% nominal growth, or the 3.8. The nominal growth is pretty much pretty much just population growth plus inflation, less productivity. And so that's how you get to that 4% kind of nominal growth level. So we think the 10-year is very, very reasonably valued. at 3.75 to 4.25 in the long run. So don't be bashing about a 10-year and trying to time whether you can pick it off at 5%. We got lucky last year. We were short the market to begin the year. All right. And I say lucky because we gradually added duration, and then just by happenstance, the 10-year treasury peaked out at about 5%. And let me tell you, when it was peaking at 5, it still could have gone to 6. All right. Nobody saw that it had to roll over, but luckily inflation was cooling quicker and the Fed was able to stop raising rates in July. That's what afforded the 10-year treasury to finally peak and then begin to roll over.
Long and short of it, it sounds like you're saying bonds are a better deal to invest in right now over the long term than stocks.
On a risk-adjusted basis, Bridgewater, who likes to say, likes to look at everything and adjust its risk to make them parity, right? Risk parity. He would say, what I would rather do is lever up bonds 3 times to get the same volatility of the stock market, and you'd end up with a better result over the long run than you would if you just had stocks on a risk-adjusted basis.
Yeah. All right. Now, going back to the economy here, it's strong, as you said. One of the things that's been holding it up is the consumer. And can that continue to happen? I guess a lot of it does depend on employment. But where do you view that?
Well, everything hinges on employment. I mean, you know, the economic cycle is the same always. And it's, I like to use the acronym COPE, C-O-P-E. When inflation's hot, the Fed raises rates, which is exactly what happened. When the Fed raises rates, they push down cyclical companies, which is what happened. You saw your auto stocks decline, the steel stocks decline, housing stocks decline, that kind of thing. Then the O part is new orders. And we saw manufacturing orders actually decline on a year-over-year basis. They are now beginning to rebound again a little bit. But for a year-over-year basis, about a half a year ago, new orders in manufacturing were declining while service was cooling. So your orders were falling, and then your profitability declines, right? Because the margins compress, because the new orders are, so your profitability starts to decline, which it did. And then when profitability declines, the CEOs look down and they say, what's my largest cost? And 70% of the cost of all goods and services in this country are labor. And so that's when they push back on employment. But profitability is actually in aggregate slightly reaccelerating. Those orders are coming back up. And so that COPE part of the cycle where you get to the employment part really hasn't materialized yet. Now, employment is cooling, absolutely cooling. In 2022, we created 4 million jobs, well, 3.8 million jobs. Last year, we created just over 2. So employment growth last year was only 52% of the employment growth the year before. So there's no doubt the trend's cooling. But demographics, we don't really have to create a ton of jobs to keep everyone fully employed. And, you know, the SOM rule there for a while was getting a lot of headlines. Basically, we need to get the unemployment rate up about 0.5% to ever get it trending far enough or assertively enough to create a situation where, you know, we end up in a recession. And so it's very difficult to get the unemployment rate to rise when you still have so many baby boomers. I'm at the very tail end of it. So I'm 62, moving on 63. I was born in 1961. Basically, when I move out, the boomers will have been done retiring and this wave of retirements will have eased somewhat. But until that slows down, basically the boomers disappearing, we don't need to create a lot of jobs to satiate, you know, all the new entrants into the workforce.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
Now, so you're in the Midwest there, and it's kind of a good bellwether, I guess. I mean, the population centers are in the Northeast. But nevertheless, there's a lot that goes on in the Midwest, and it can be kind of a good, like I said, bellwether for middle America, since it is right in the middle there. And are you picking up anything there locally that you think is either good, bad, or indifferent?
Well, you know, certainly the central parts of the country are in awfully good shape. And of course, is basically does its business between Denver and Cincinnati, Chicago and Houston. Mm-hmm. That's kind of our core center. And, you know, Kansas City's in awfully good shape. Oklahoma City with the oil, the fracking and all that, Tulsa, and Texas, of course, still remains on fire with all the jobs moving. We're also the seventh largest user of cards in the country. And so we get, you know, a lot of data from Visa. And, you know, Visa will tell you that there's a sharp slowdown in spending from the West Coast moving towards the East. And so feels pretty good here in the Midwest, but recognizing in California and Oregon and in Seattle and Washington, those states are close to recessionary levels, if not in an outright recession. So it really depends upon, and it's always that way. It always kind of depends on where you are in this country on whether or not you're feeling the effects or the gross effects of a slowdown. But I think the Midwest has remained relatively largely immune to the slowdown so far. And the slowdown, for the first time in my lifetime, largely except for the 1990 recession, seems to be coming in from the West moving east, as opposed to something bad going in the Northeast or something and pushing its way through the rest of the country.
Why is that? Is that because of the tech sector out there?
I don't want to get into politics too much, but I think, you know, you've seen a flood of people leaving California for lower tax states, and then businesses relocating. And of course, the tech sector having been the huge driver, actually we're seeing, that's where we're seeing, you know, the job growth cool the most. And then add to that the urban flight, if you will, from, you know, the ability to work like I'm working right now from a hotel room to you. You know, the carving out of Los Angeles and San Francisco and Seattle and Portland has just been massive. And so that's been a huge drag. Then we'll throw commercial property headaches on top of it. The biggest banking failures were all located in California last year. I think you can see that basically, you know, spending's on a relative basis slowing there first and working its way kind of easterly.
And that sounds a little disconcerting, but not enough for you to lower your forecast or anything like that.
In the fourth quarter last year, Visa was adamant that there might be a recession coming in the first quarter of this year. That's how adamant they were about this. So they get real-time data on a moment-by-moment basis. A bank does too, though, where you see delinquencies and charge-offs, all very, very well-behaved. The big problems will come as this wall of fixed income debt matures and has to be refinanced. And of course, you're seeing that in the commercial property space, but it's not just commercial property. It's every organization that has term debt. And we had, and these organizations had 15 years to term out their debt. We took great advantage of that in this country. It's the biggest reason that we've been able to withstand these higher interest rates is that for most people, it hasn't impacted them at all. Everybody in the country who has a mortgage took out a fixed rate mortgage. Nobody was dumb enough to take out an adjustable rate mortgage. And it's not hyperbole there. It was 99% of all mortgages while those rates were super low and the refinancings were entirely fixed rate. So from a consumer's perspective that have all locked in their low fixed rate mortgages, they're in awfully good shape. Most of them took out a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. Businesses were smart enough too. The average corporate bond maturity from pre-pandemic to post-pandemic increased several years. It used to be about 9-year average maturity in the corporate bond market. It's much closer to 12 today. So the corporate treasuries took advantage of it. State and local governments were smart enough to borrow long-term. And even our treasury, even the treasury was smart enough, our U.S. treasury, to extend the length of the average maturity of debt. They're reversing that now, by the way. You probably heard that there isn't as much bond issuance, note and bond issuance, and more bill issuance. So they seem to be pulling this back the other way. It's not like they have inside information as to what the Fed's up to, but they have inside information as to what the Fed's up to. And they've concluded it's probably smarter to finance our deficit with slightly higher cost short-term debt, because that'll be refinanceable more quickly at a lower rate, not in the not too distant future.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
By the way, you don't need the .tech suffix to get to that website. .com will do the trick. And we also have a Substack where you can sign up for the same prices, same benefits, same details, contrarianpod.substack.com. So if you already have a Substack account and use it, or have the app and use that, that's probably the best way to go. So contrarian.supercast.com or contrarianpod.substack.com, whole bunch of benefits including, of course, getting this episode up to a week early without ads or annoying announcements. And you also get the Daily Contrarian briefing and podcast that is released every market day morning at 7 a.m. This is a contrarian take on the events of the day ahead and what is likely to move markets, such as economic data releases, earnings, and other things. It is really good, and that is completely unbiased, of course. So check that out, contrarianpod.substack.com or contrarian.supercast.tech. Now on with the show. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't think about that. All the refinancing at such lower rates, that would have a carry-on effect.
We had 15 years, and our debt, while it was in aggregate, our debt was, you know, less than it was part of the subprime crisis. In aggregate, we had 15 years to really lock in ultra-low coupon. And so that's the biggest reason that these higher interest rates didn't bite more assertively, more aggressively. On the other hand, in the commercial property space, nobody that owns a commercial property building is getting refinanced at all, unless it's at semi-distressed levels or they're all having to put equity into it. So that's kind of the canary in the coal mine. The subprime crisis, of course, started. And you know, you could look at subprime and say, well, subprime was only 1/4 of all mortgage issuance. And so if you took that number, that was about $3.5 trillion. And you said, even if every subprime person defaulted, you only lose 10 or 20% when you know, a house goes bad at worst. And our banking system and capital markets can handle that. What we didn't understand was there was this compounding effect that so much of the lending had been done on a levered basis. In other words, that the banks still had these loans on their books. And of course, a bank is a hedge fund in disguise with only 10% capital. When those start to charge off, it eats your capital very quickly. Fannie Mae was the classic example of this, but they only had 3% capital. And I guess Lehman Brothers was the 31 times levered situation there too. If the commercial property ends up being in levered situations, then there will be a bigger compounding effect than we know. But most people that own commercial property own it in a CMBS or, you know, directly on the bank's balance sheet. It's not terribly levered like it was in the subprime situation.
Yeah, I would think that it's less the case. And also, I mean, how do they handle the default? Like there was all these credit default swaps floating around on RMBS and such. And do they? I imagine there's some kind of credit default swaps for commercial, maybe not.
Certainly they are, but you know, the big holders of the support or the subordinate tranches of this are basically these, I'll call them business development corporations, yeah, or where all the money is flowing to the higher yielding debt. And it's not the distressed debt, but just the privately placed debt. Mm. These folks have a lot of subordinate debt. But you know, during the internet bubble, I think it's a good example of this, where the internet bubble, you know, crashed, the stock market was down 50%, NASDAQ was down 85%. But it was a very mild recession because nobody owned those things in a levered basis. And these, you know, these higher yielding funds aren't levered up 2-to-1. It's just an equity alternative for a pension fund or an endowment fund at a college or assertive investors. And I think they'll show up as equity-like losses. And equity-like losses, because they're cash-like losses, aren't a big deal to the country as a whole. It's when it's levered and you immediately have to start selling and you lose all of your capital quickly that it becomes kind of a contagionary event.
Yeah. And the, you know, proverbial run on the banks, obviously, is what you want to avoid.
I mean, I've got a lot of exposure in terms of commercial property at the AAA level. And people said that with the subprime. But if you had honest to God subprime exposure at the AAA level where you really were in the senior position, it was pretty hard to lose a lot of money or lose almost any money. It was those subordinate securities that took the lumps. And then it was the weird part was they took all those subordinate securities, all the triple B and double B and single B subordinate securities. They put them into that new bathtub. If you recall from the movie, the Michael Lewis movie about the Big Short. And you took all those junior bonds, you put them in a new bathtub. And Moody said, well, you know, half of those are bound to pay off. We'll give that a AAA rating. It's those bottom ones that won't pay off. But it turns out when the subordinate bonds went bad, they went bust quickly and all that water drained out. Those AAA rated, but junior AAA rated securities, that really doesn't exist in the subprime or in the commercial mortgage space.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's good to know.
Yeah.
All right. Moving along here. There is a, as you may have heard, a presidential election this year.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say there's uncertainty around it, but there isn't because we pretty much know the two candidates. Pretty much, I guess there's some, but let's not get into political discussion for a number of reasons. It's not what we do. But economically and market-wise, what are your views on that, and how can that all play out?
Well, from an equity markets perspective, a lot of people try and follow the presidential cycle, where typically the fourth year is the worst cycle, the third year is the best, which is just what we went through. As they, you know, they you come up with a rationale for why the third year is the best, and the rationale is something like, well, the federal government wants to do everything it can, pulls out all the stops, is willing to spend money to create an economic environment so the president can get reelected. And if you think about it, the debt, the GDP level actually accelerated last year, which is weird in a recovery. It went from about 5.3%, maybe no, it was 5.4 in 2022. It was 6.3. It accelerated by 0.9%. So some of our tailwind for this economy is deficit spending. And of course, the market was up, 26% last year. So the toughest year, where it's a close to a zero return, is the fourth year of a presidential cycle, where the market is very uncertain about, the outcome of the election and the policies
Now, hang on.
afterwards.
Is that true for first term and lame duck presidents? Or because there might be a difference there, right? If you look at the history.
You would think there, but this is for every fourth
Okay.
year, any president, whether they're a lame duck or not lame duck. And yeah, you're right. You think if you're a lame duck president, why would you be trying to juice the economy up? Well, you're doing that because you've got a vice president that wants to become president. I think now that's a gross generalization on my part, not backed up by any facts whatsoever.
Right.
But it just seems to be the seasonality, if you will, of the presidential cycle. So you've got two candidates. I don't think the neither party is grossly, happy with, and that the whole country is, kind of bifurcated about. So it's a, it, you know, when you look at the consumer confidence, depending on whether you're a Democrat or Republican, your attitude towards the world is much different than it's ever been. It's the widest discrepancy. When you ask Democrats on the consumer confidence survey, they're 40 points higher in terms of economic confidence than a Republican who's asked the exact same question. That's the widest disparity ever in that polling by the University of Michigan's consumer confidence surveys. So obviously there's some problem there that you know the Republicans view the market as just so terrible, and Democrats view it as probably better. I always like to tell my Republican friends that it's not nearly as bad as you think, and I tell my Democratic friends that it's probably not as good as you think.
Talk about divorced from reality. God.
Yeah, for those that hang on that, you need we used to have a more happy median. I'm not saying that a happy median is necessarily good either, but I don't think that the and I think that the markets pick up on that, and I don't think that you're going to see the markets run away. Even though from a technical perspective they've broken into new highs, I don't think you're going to see the equity markets run away from you this year until there becomes more certainty on the outlook, particularly the elevated. And I always people always say, well, what about the geopolitical risks? And I said, well, when aren't there geopolitical risks? But it does feel like it's exceptionally, higher today. The situation, of course, in the Middle East kind of, flared up. We still have the ongoing Russian situation, and then kind of a wrenching, tightening situation with regard to Iran, North Korea, and certainly China and Taiwan.
Yeah, former President Trump claims, rightfully or wrongly, that to be pro-business and pro-market and things like that. Could there be, if he is elected, could that cause there to be a rally, or is it just people expect the status quo and nobody really cares?
I do think that absolutely the first year of a presidential cycle usually pretty positive. And yeah, I know.
Yeah, 2017 was great. Yeah.
I think the markets will react favorably to a Trump, re-election, and I don't think the markets will be grossly disappointed if Biden's elected either. So I think it's a positive. It's positive just to get some clarity in the future. Now, there might be more clarity, really, if you think about it, with Biden and some consistency, because with regard to Trump, he's churns through cabinets, and you're not exactly sure who's going to come in or really what his policies really are. There's a lot of talk and then not nearly as much change at the margin.
Yeah, true enough. Wow, okay, interesting. So we touched on it. What are some of the things, I mean, broadly positive, broadly optimistic, But what are some of the things that you're concerned about here as we look to 2024 and going forward as well?
So I figured you might ask that. So I down and I my scribbling is always my penmanship is pretty
I
poor.
hate it when that happens.
I put the number one thing is the growing deficit spending here from the United States. If you look at where all the debt accumulation has been, it's been at the government level. Now, if you want anyone to spend during a pandemic, you might as well have it be the government. In fact, the world's most powerful government, who finances its deficits at, at reasonable levels because of the dollar is so strong and everything. But government debt to GDP, of course, we all know is about a little over one times. You've heard number of times that it's the highest level except for a brief period of time after World War II. And unfortunately, countries like ours can continue to grow that debt to GDP until finally they strangle themselves and hang themselves. And apparently we're headed that direction. We still have a lot of rope left. But I think that's my number one concern, really, is that they've got to, there's got to be some consensus to bring the deficit. The deficit last year is 6.3% of GDP. We always run a deficit. Now, only 3 years, like since 1945, have we had a balanced budget practically. And the budget deficit typically runs at about 4% of GDP. But we need to bring it back down to something approaching the nominal levels of growth in the long run so that the ratios. So that's one problem. And of course, when you look at the what it's going to cost to finance this deficit, it continues to ratchet up as a percent of GDP, as a cost, as a percent of GDP, it'll reach 3.5%, an all-time high in 2026, just as it stands today because of this. And so that does crowd out, all the other government domestic spending. And so that's a slow-moving albatross around our necks.
And there's no political will to do anything about it, right? I mean, it seems like it's been a long time since the Republicans were the party of fiscal restraint and fiscal conservative. I mean, some of them maybe tried to still make some noise about that, but
Five or six of them out there that really
yeah.
gum up the work, so to speak, for the rest of the other representatives and senators. But no, they all seem to go along, don't they? And the deficits rose under Reagan, as we all remember that, and they rose under Bush. And oddly enough, Clinton, of all the people, was the one that created the biggest budget on a relative basis over time, and still had, a 10-year economic expansion. That'd be my biggest worry, is how are you going to start that, and of course the ratcheting up in that. Number two is that nominal growth is slowing. Don't kid yourself. The economy is slowing in reaction to these higher interest rates, and as we distance ourselves from all of the pandemic rapid deficit spending that was pushed into the economy. So we are cooling, and a recession kind of occurs in about 3 months, and no one really sees it coming all the time. And even though we all have all these people looking at it like me and then everybody else, it just kind of seems to come out of nowhere. Usually there's a spark that creates it that everyone kind of sort of maybe saw coming, but never knew when it was going to materialize. So, we are in a slowdown mode, and we are slowing. Employment growth is slowing, wages are slowing. There's clearly going to be some slowdown in deficit spending, which means we're going to have less tailwind to continue the expansion. Our service PMIs are cooling, and of course, we're 70% service, 30% manufacturing economy. The service PMIs continue to cool, and while the manufacturing was kind of in a recessionary territory and now is beginning to rebound, we still have some, cooling on the service side. I talked about the employment growth only being 52% of what it was the prior year. And if you take that one, the 2 million jobs created, and divide it by 12, you do get a number per month that's lower than the average of the previous expansion. We created about 180,000 jobs per month in the previous expansion. So there are some cracks in employment. It's slowing. The quit rate is declining. In other words, people willing to say, take this job and shove it, have clearly come down. Wage and salaries are slowing. The number of job openings has declined. And then probably the biggest headache in all that is the average work week is declining. And you say, well, what could that possibly mean? It's declined by about an hour, meaning that we're working the workforce one less hour than we were the year before. Well, that's a massive amount of slack that you're creating when you do that. If we're working people 40 hours a week and suddenly working 39, that's using your employment 2.5% less. We only grew employment 1.2% last year. So that's like letting go all the jobs created last year and then half the jobs before when you're working everyone an hour less. So there are clearly some cracks, you know, in the economy. They're not showing through. We see the West Coast cracks working their way to the East Coast. You have all the fixed rate debt that needs to be refinanced. So we're not out of the woods by any stretch of the imagination. It's just that, you know, you don't have a recession until employment gets to zero. What's going to drive employment to zero? It's normally the margin compression and profitability compression. And oddly enough, profits are likely to be higher in aggregate for the S&P 500 this year than they were the year before. And so until the profits fall and the orders getting to the near zero or negative side, you don't get the employment. And it's when you get to zero job growth that you get a recession. To the day you hear the Department of Labor tell us that there were no jobs created last month is the day the recession started.
Yeah. On productivity and potential productivity gains, have you as an economist seen any productivity gains from this whole AI revolution that is supposedly happening?
None. Zero.
Okay.
Although productivity is increasing after it was declining for a while, but those are noisy statistics that bounce around. Will there be, you know, I mean, look, computers have added to productivity forever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they'll continue to add. And I think AI will continue just along at the same. I don't think it's the revolutionary force that people say it was. And, you know, just like the internet was certainly changed everything, but it took a long time for that to happen. Will AI change everything? I'm trying to incorporate it, but, you know, so my mid-year outlook, I tried to use AI to write my outlook. I said, all right, let's see how well this works. Well, it comes up with an outlook you don't like. And so you just have to tell it then other things. You say, well, we'll make it a little more pessimistic. And then I said, well, what about this? What about that? What about job growth? What about overseas? What about geopolitical? And by the time you spec it all out, you've written the whole thing for the darn, you know, program. Now, and basically, if you didn't have you need to give it a gross outline of where you want to go. Now, on the other hand, I also did this. I said, write a bank report, you know, as though you're a CEO for a bank. Write that. And there that, you know, it got, you know, it had 50 good reports to pull from. It wrote a pretty beautiful outlook, you know, just as a CEO would write, you know, for his shareholders, that kind of thing, because it had more data to glom onto.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think that, you know, the more data it has and the better it gets and the more access it has, when I say it, whatever it really is, I think you can get better and better outcomes. And then, of course, like I think AI becomes like your phone that has too many apps on it. Right. I've got so many apps. I have to search for them now on my phone. Yeah. I think we get very specialized applications for AI in everyone's occupation or everyone's job. And it certainly helps you get where you want to go faster.
Mm.
The conferences that I go to, what I hear out of people is that where they thought they might have to add bodies, AI has helped them from having to add that body. It's not adding to any firings, but it's slowing the need for an additional body at the market.
Okay, so that'll help profitability.
It should help profitability. I mean, productivity, you know, ultimately, you know, accrues to both labor and the man, if you will. Who owns all the equity. But you know, the balance of who wins in that, of course, has been grossly towards the stock side. But more recently, because of the tightness in the labor market, you know, labor has gotten back a little bit of its share of gross revenues.
Last question. Can the Chiefs win?
Well, the Midwest and the Kansas City in particular, and I'm sitting in a hotel room in Kansas City right now. So it's ecstatic. Absolutely. The Chiefs can win because they've got Mahomes, they've got Andy Reid, and they just seem to find a way to get things done.
They have that other guy dating Taylor Swift. I forgot his name, but
right. I was out here. And in fact, in one of my last economic overviews where I did for a bank audience in St. Louis, and I still have it in my presentation. It's that line that Taylor Swift have, hi, it's me. I'm the problem. It's me, or something like that. She has, these are my assistants that stuck this station, but it's the big government debt that I would suggest is the problem, largely the problem here. So, but you know, it's going to be a tough football game, and the Chiefs have been playing kind of the best football they played all season. All right. And that's what it takes to get to the Super Bowl. And then usually weird things happen in the Super Bowl. It tends to break one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see who shows up to play 2 weeks from now. Very surprised how how well they you know, how much better they got when they absolutely needed to get better just when they hit the playoffs.
Yeah, and they beat some really good teams and deserve to be there. In closing, maybe you can tell our listeners how they can find out more about you, how to get in touch. I will put this all in the show notes as well.
And then, of course, for Commerce Bank shares, CBSH is the ticker for Commerce Bank. We're about the 40th largest bank in the country, about the 20th largest by market cap. And then Commerce Trust, the department I work in within Commerce Bank, is just the money management arm for Commerce. And if you Google my name or Commerce Trust or Commerce Bank, you'll be able to find all the information we put out, all the videos we put out, all of our research. And I guess I'll give a plug for my mutual fund, the biggest one I run, CFBNX, which is the $1 billion, 30-year managed fund that we has a lot of course diversified monies in it from around the country.
Great. I will put those links in the show notes as well, so you have them handy. Thank you, Scott, for joining us again today. Thank you all for listening. And with that, we'll leave it there. We'll be back here again in a couple of weeks. Speak then. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.